Just turn my phone off here. Okay.
Happy to be here today with Clara Gaddy, who I met at the Northwest Estuary 2024 Encountering Face-to-Face Conference, the conference with the longest name in the history of the world. And I was fascinated by a project that Clara is working on, so I wanted her to tell us about that. But Clara, could you also give us a little background about maybe where you grew up, how you grew up, and how you got interested in this project that you're doing?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Clara. I'm a sociology student at Notre Dame, and it was really fun to meet you at a conference actually, because Karen came and rescued me from the hotel. I was a little bit stranded, so that's how I got to know Karen. And so the project I'm working on is it's really fun. I'm watching all of these YouTube videos on this little corner of the internet. Especially, Paul Vanderclay's channel and people who are connected to him, because I wanted to find out how people are building community in online spaces. And then I was so excited to go to Northwest Estuary because I also wanted to see how, when people met online, how that was sort of panning out in their face-to-face conversations as well. And so even the title of the conference really captured me, because this face-to-face thing is kind of exciting, and it's happening right now, and it's very new. But part of my project also, Karen, is looking at how people's religious identities and their maybe their other identities as well change over time as they sort of come into both real life community, sorry, real life. That's a confusing term, in-person community and online community. So how folks are changing as they're encountering community. And so this just seemed like the absolute perfect place. A friend of mine from real life in a coffee shop, who I had I'd been working with people in his community, studying the same questions. He told me about this online space, and he said, "Well, what you're doing, these kind of randos conversations, is if people are doing these online." And I told him for about 2 years that I didn't really have any bandwidth to watch YouTube videos. But eventually I watched a few and I said, "Wow, this is really happening. You're right." So that's kind of how I got started. So just sitting in a coffee shop in Indiana, chatting with regular folks and sort of
Well, so
hearing their
let's go
stories.
back a step. How did you come to a place in life where you decided to study sociology at Notre Dame? I mean, how did you
Well,
grow up and what was your interest when you were growing up?
sure. I grew up in a sort of a suburb in the Midwest here. I grew up in Kentucky. I grew up in a home. I actually have four siblings, and my parents are married, and I grew up in a Southern Baptist church as a sort of a regular attender. My family always joked that we were there every time the doors were open. And it was, to a point, it was kind of true. All sorts of programs and things like that. So kind of what you're asking. So we were very involved as a family. And that was sort of our religious life growing up. My mother started working nights as a nurse when I was a teenager. And I grew up in this sort of world where I was sort of allowed to. I remember here's something, a story I like to tell is, my mother regularly took us to the library when we were growing up, like the public library. And, she would kind of walk around and, help us to choose books to read. And then I think she always kind of says that she should have followed a calling as like an elementary school teacher instead of a nurse, But so she's a very cool person, my mother. And so one day she took me and she said, "Okay, one day my father told me that I could read any book in the library, and here's this day, this sort of special day, you can read any book that appeals to you." And I didn't know, as a kid, you're like, "Okay, whatever. I'm gonna check out a Stephen King book just to kind of, test the boundary, right?" But very quickly I realized that that meant that I could ask whatever question I wanted to ask, and I could study. I remember I read every book on the shelf. There's a sort of section of shelves. There's all the books about like creationism and evolution and Christianity and those types of things. And I went back to the library one day, as you know, in high school, and I said, I've read every book on the shelf. Like, where do I go next? Interlibrary loan, of course, is the answer to that. But when you have questions like that, and you're always kind of trying to tug at the answers, so that was just kind of how I was thinking and growing up and stuff. And so you went to college, and you go to college, and you're like, well, I thought I could ask any question before, but now I really can't ask any question, right? And then grad school, it's even more free, right? So this has sort of been about asking questions and answering them. We're looking for the answer.
So help me out a little bit, because I'm so old that when I went to school, they didn't teach sociology. So what is sociology?
Sociology is the study of people and groups. And so I'm studying a little branch of that, micro sociology. And so I'm also looking at people's life histories, and I'm looking really at this moment of interaction. So when people are gathered face to face, that's a situation. And so looking at that situation and saying, how are these relationships forming? What's happening in that moment of interaction? And how does that carry on to the next moment of interaction? If that makes sense at all.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's very consonant with Verveke's work on dialogos and just the reality of what conversations look like, especially in this little corner where there seems to be a lot of space in between the two people where it leaves room to reflect. I don't know if you've heard me tell this story before or not, but when I first started the channel, I've been going for maybe a month or two, and one of the frequent commenters was a guy by the name of Michael. And one day Michael commented, and he said, I don't know what it is about your channel. He said, it's so fascinating. He said, you don't know what you're talking about, and your guest doesn't know what they're talking about. But between the two of you, it opens up a space for the rest of us to learn something.
Wow. Yeah.
And I invited him to come on. And then after that, he and I would have weekly conversations for a long time. And he is a fascinating thinker. And that opened up a space for other people to think about things, you know? And so I think there is something about that, just having just normal people having a conversation together can open up a space for lots of fertile new things to happen. Yeah.
Absolutely. I heard you say in your recent talk at the Shuri conference about, you know, seeing what's not seen or something, and sort of filling in those kinds of spaces, I think. I was intrigued by that. I thought, wow, that really is happening here.
Yeah. So let's go back and talk about the conference a little bit. So it was in Olympia, Washington, which is a beautiful area. And they were holding it at a church. It wasn't a Christian event or anything, but they were using a church facility. Very nicely offered us their facility to use. So you walk into this space, never having met any of these people before. What was your first reaction?
Well, I'd been to the barbecue the night before.
That's right. Yeah.
So like that was just like that sort of first reaction there, sort of kind of pulling up. I think we were together, like sort of rolling up to the barbecue, kind of, oh, okay, here we are. We're in the right space, right? And then I put my things, you know, kind of in a corner, and I was kind of amazed for a minute just to sort of see, you know, sort of like a first glance, like, oh wow, you know, look at these people just happily sitting at tables, and I know you, I know you, I know you, and I, you know, of course, I'd never met any of these people, but I had been watching them for a few months. And then when people started kind of coming up to me and saying hello and knowing who I was, you know, that's kind of cool. There's something special there where people really want to connect, you know? And so, I mean, Nate's an amazing chef, right? So you were at the barbecue, Karen, what were you thinking?
Well, for me, it's always, like you say, it's kind of startling when you see people. I knew a lot of those people from conversations that I'd had with them on my channel, but a lot of them I only knew through watching them on somebody else's conversation. And there's something very, I don't know, there's something very mysterious that happens when you walk into a space and there's real live people there. The first time it happened to me was when I was at the Chino conference about a year and a half ago, and I met somebody that I had only seen online and had never actually talked to online. I met them in person, and it felt almost like there was gold dust falling from the ceiling in between the two of us, because that real person was so much more real. Well, I don't know if that's exactly right. There's also something Jonathan Peugeot talked about this one time about how when we're on these screens, there's a light behind us. So there's a light that comes through us from the screen. And so people are naturally kind of illuminated from within on the screen, which kind of adds to their persona, if you will. Even if you're trying your best to be a real person, a real, authentic, just normal human being, the fact that you're on a screen already gives you some kind of star power, if you would. Like when you walked into the barbecue and everybody's walking up, oh, Clara, Clara, you know, I've seen you online before. It's almost like a meeting of movie stars. Oh, yeah, I saw your movie. I saw your movie. Right.
Yeah, but nobody's trying to
So,
like play it off or anything. It's just kind of,
yeah. So you met all these people, and what was your impression of them?
just what a gift, right? Because, sometimes you're a little bit anxious kind of going into these spaces, right? And you're like, oh, maybe this person doesn't like me, or oh, this person and I might disagree about, this particular thing, right? But then, like you say, this kind of humanity of it, people met and there was no disagreement. There was no rehashing of whatever happened online. So that was, I don't want to say it was surprising to me because obviously I would be very optimistic, right, about things just going absolutely well. But I felt, Karen, that things went just so beautifully well, just really exceeding maybe anybody's expectation, just how warm and hospitable and is that what you were thinking?
Well, I'm just drinking it in. I'm enjoying what you're saying here. So the next day after the barbecue, you went into the larger room with all these people, and a lot of those people you'd probably never even seen online before. And yeah, so tell me a little bit about that experience. I'm also kind of, the reason I'm asking you these questions is there might be people watching thinking, "Ooh, would I dare to go one of these conferences? What would it be like, you know?" And since you have kind of fresh eyes because you had never been to one before, and you haven't been involved with the little corner for all that long, and so you come to it with fresh eyes. Plus, you're coming to it with the eyes of a sociologist, so you have a kind of a unique perspective because you're also looking at it for, you have various reasons that you're kind of looking at this thing. So you can give us a viewpoint that not very many people can. So.
Okay, so to tell you the truth, I was coming from my Airbnb and I was just sure I knew the way, right? It was just past the Mormon church, right? And up this log cabin road. So before I got there, of course, I got very lost, right? Because I was coming on foot from this Airbnb. And so I got there before things started, but I was feeling like I was late. And just kind of, is this it? Is this the right place? And then this guy comes and greets me, and he doesn't have an official role. He doesn't have to greet me, but he says, "Hey, are you looking for the event?" And he kind of knew who I was, and just kind of showed me where to go. And I just thought that was just incredible. I mean, incredibly kind, right? Because I am there. I'm a sociologist. I'm here to take notes or whatever, and here to meet people and here to talk to people and be part of the thing. But also, I'll say it, what I've heard tons of other people say, I'm a little bit fringe, right? And then I was just welcomed right in and shown right to the coffee, which is sort of, really what I'm also kind of secretly looking for, but afraid to say. And so they knew me, they knew what I was looking for, and they took care of it. They anticipated my needs and showed me exactly where to go. And so I found my estuary group and I knew someone in there. And so it was just a really warm kind of experience, which I wasn't expecting, honestly, because I'm not a churchgoer, and there I was in this church, So I don't know.
Well, and we have to say, Nate set the bar kind of high for every estuary from now on, because on the first morning he had French pastries from a special bakery, and they were amazing. I don't know that that anybody's going to be able to beat that in the future. You know, whether maybe they can do that in Chicago. Get ready, guys.
Yeah. There's
Yeah.
some good bakers out there.
So for the people who are listening who don't know anything about conferences like this, it's set up so that the main show really are these estuary groups, which are kind of small conversational groupings for people to, as one person put it, it's a place where you can come and talk about whatever is on your mind that you can't talk about anywhere else, because either nobody would be interested or it would be too fringe and you might be on the outside for wanting to talk about it. But at Estuary, you can talk about those things and there will be people who will engage with you about these things. So it started with an Estuary meeting even before there were any speakers on tap. And that gave us a chance to get to know like the eight, seven or eight people that were in our group. So were you the only woman in your group?
No, there were actually two other women, three other there were three other women in my group, so
They stacked your group.
they did. And it was pretty balanced in that way. What about your group, Karen? Who was in your group?
There were eight of us, and there was myself and one married couple. So there was another woman, but all the others were guys. And I think there were some groups where there was just one woman. And because we are a little bit male heavy.
That's true. It would be a little weird to be a one woman group, I think.
Yeah, although I think all the guys were, very gracious, but they can get talking about their topics that they've been talking about on Discord for 3 or 4 years, and it can kind of get up in there.
Oh,
If you're not familiar with it, you can feel a little bit lost, but yeah. I too was struck by just how warm all the greetings were from people. And for me personally, it was kind of funny because I tend to think of my channel as being a place where people come to learn about science and philosophy and things like that. But I discovered pretty early on in the conference that what people really wanted to hear from me were stories about my childhood, because they think of me as a grandma they want to hear about what it was like in the old days. So, it's a good place to learn a little humility. And then I had to learn even more humility, because every time any of the gentlemen saw me walking up the steps to the stage, they came rushing up to help me as though they thought I couldn't make it up the stairs by myself. But it was cute. I mean, it was very cute, and I was very appreciative. But finally, by the last day, I was running up the steps so nobody would come and help me.
good for you, Karen. Good for you.
So, yeah, it was a lot of fun that way. It's fun to be surrounded by a lot of men who really want to be gentlemen and really want to learn how to be heroes and warriors and all of that. It's very fun.
Did you meet any guys who specifically, surprised you or stuck out to you?
No, I don't think they surprised me or stuck out to me. I mean, the guys that were attending to my elderly
This is
my
funny because you don't look
elderly
elderly at all, right?
needs. The guys who were attending to me were guys that I have talked to on the channel before in the past, and so and they're just real gentlemen, like Corey and Jeremy and I mean, I know there were others. I just can't think of right off the cuff right now. But it always amazes me. It's not this is not the right word, because it's used as a pejorative nowadays, but they were very solicitous. They were concerned. They were concerned about my needs, and they wanted to make sure that my needs were taken care of. And, in normal life, you don't run into very many people like that. You have to do your thing and you have to take care of yourself, and there's nobody around to kind of watch every step that you make and make sure that everything is okay. Maybe you got that when you were a baby and your mama was taking care of you, but when you get to be an adult, it's very, very rare to have so many people concerned about your every movement. And so that was fun. It was very interesting. But then you come back to real life and you still have to clean the toilets at home and cook the meals and take care of things. So, your experience the first day started with the estuary group, and then there were the speakers. And was that when the speakers started? Was that a different kind of a feeling that than you get when you're in an academic setting?
That's an interesting question, because you know I've been to a lot of academic talks, and this was really geared toward. I think the speakers, especially you, Karen, were way more attentive to, you know, this is how I want to engage with this group, rather than, and I think I heard you say something along these lines as well, just rather than like, you know, here's what I have to say to you, and better stick in, you know, like this is the right answer or whatever. And I did. I really saw, especially from you, and then from others as well. Maybe because I was attuned, because we had maybe talked about it, that you were looking for. Is this right? You were looking for, you know, what does this audience want to me? How do they want to engage with me? And I definitely saw you do that, and I definitely saw, I think Michael Martin do that, and I think I saw Dr. Green do that. So I just sort of all these examples of what I would say is amazing pedagogy, right? Like. Sort of anticipating, again, this sort of anticipation and attunement to, you know, what do these people want or need, or how can they sort of bounce back and engage? I saw that rhythm kind of develop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was one of the things I was really amazed by was how Nate put that group of speakers together, because there were six speakers from widely divergent fields and widely divergent ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it sort of made this thread that all tied together. I mean, I don't know how it happened, but the same thing kind of happens in an estuary group when you're at the beginning, everybody gets to name a topic that they would like to talk about. And then we kind of negotiate or navigate which of those topics we're going to discuss. And generally, what happens is you find a through line that goes through all the topics and weaves into a larger topic that allows everybody to get to explore a little bit about what they were thinking. But at the same time, it allows the group to gather around a main kind of meta topic, I guess you would say. And that's the way it felt at the conference, that there's six different people talking about six completely different things. And yet you could see that the meta topic at the top that joined all of them together. And I think that must have been what was in Nate's head when he chose the speakers, which is pretty amazing.
It was so cool. And I loved just sort of this way that he approached it, from like, okay, we're going to have a couple of people who are clergy persons. We're going to have somebody who's very movement oriented, who's going to sort of show us maybe some grounding sort of techniques. I think that might be what Rafe was doing. And we're going to have these poets, and we're going to have music and poetry just interwoven into this way of you know, this dialogue between the speakers and each other, and the speakers and the estuary groups. I really did see that rhythm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think one of the other things that makes it work is that the people who've been developing this idea of estuary have been training leaders for estuary groups for quite some time. So I believe that all the leaders that were kind of facilitators in the various estuary groups had gone through this training program. So they understood what it takes to allow people to open up about difficult topics and to be willing to accept disagreements and find a way to accept fringe ideas without, you know, you don't have to sacrifice your own principles, and still you can find a way to communicate with each other and find meaningful relationship. So that was very beautiful. That was one of the things I really appreciated about the estuary groups.
Absolutely. I was amazed, Karen, about how just kind of, people engage that level of vulnerability that you don't see that in everyday life. And it takes, you pulling kind of have to pull the thread a little bit to get that out of someone, or to navigate in that direction. But there wasn't any pulling here. People were, they were ready to go. I don't see that in my sometimes in a community that kind of knows each other, but not in many other spaces.
Well, yeah, I mean, so at the very start of the conference, you sign in, you go into a meeting room with eight people you've never met before, and you're in the deep end of the pool in 15 minutes, right? Was that scary?
Oh, was it scary? Yeah, because here's the thing. It's sort of the topics are going around, and like somebody shared something personal, and I'm over here like, am I gonna have to share something personal? I don't know if other people are thinking that, but you kind of choose your own adventure, so it's a little bit more chill in that way. I mean, I felt like nobody was really pressured to share anything, but there is a little bit of, oh no, kind of sneaky sort of. This is coming around to me, and I've got this story. Do I share it? Do I not? Do I share it? Do I not? Maybe I'm the only one. Maybe I'm like sort of the cynic of the group. But I guess there's a space for the cynic as well, I think, in the estuary.
Well, so what was the topic that you wanted to discuss? And then, did you get to discuss it, or did they discuss some other topic?
I think we ended up discussing every single topic. But I was so interested as our group kind of went around, like people were sharing, oh, I'm an ex, I belonged to this religion, or I belonged to that other religion, and then I left that religion. That story sort of permeated our group. So many people had had that experience, or had experiences with divorce or other kinds of leaving. And so I was really interested in sort of weaving those stories together. I guess that's a round two sort of question, I guess. But in terms of people's stories, like that was just so interesting to me, as sort of everybody kind of had that in common, and that was sort of coming out just as we were getting to know each other. And so that was kind of one of the themes that sort of, even the whole weekend, people kind of were looking at their identities in that way of, I used to be this and now I'm this. But I might have just been sort of primed to think with those kind of questions, right? Because that's very close to what I study.
So was that your topic then? When it came around to you and they said, "What do you want to talk about, Clara?" What did you say?
Well, okay, so this is a test of my memory here. What did I say? I'm sure he said something safe, something like something that would be a good enough answer to make it clear that I took it seriously, but something that wouldn't be personal. But I don't remember what that was, probably because, you've been in a group like this, Karen. You got to say something that's safe. I don't know. That's the truthful answer. And I'm sure other people
Well,
might.
here I'm pushing you, I'm pushing you, pushing you, and then I'm trying to think myself, what was my topic? And I can't remember.
Because I think that's the genius, though, of it coming around and around and around. Because for me, the first time, I'm always going to say something safe. I'm going to go with the estuarially topic and suggest better snacks or something like that, right?
Yeah, or yeah. I mean, for me, sometimes the something safe is some big idea that I'm thinking about. Because if we're talking about some big idea, that's not going to get too close to what's, down in here, or some aspect of life that's hard to handle. Because we can talk about ideas. Ideas are always safe, right?
Yeah. Oh,
Yeah.
this is what the speaker was thinking, and it's far away from my daily life.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now that we're both sort of saying that, it's kind of strange then how we ended up talking about lots of really personal things. How did that happen?
It is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I I don't, it, that, I think that's the magic of estuary, really. It's the magic of it. Partly because the first round is where you talk about who you are. You introduce yourself, right? And then after you introduce yourself, at least this time around, in a normal estuary meeting, that first round would be maybe 15 minutes. But this time we had an hour, I think, for the first estuary meeting. So that getting to know each other was a little bit more extended, which allowed maybe a little bit more personal information to come out in the getting to know each other thing. So then by the time you come around to the topics in the second round, which I believe was 2 hours, we had 2 hours in the second session, which is a long time to be able to have a group conversation. There's a lot of space for interaction to take place. So during that second round, when people started bringing up topics, then we could say something like, oh, I can see why that topic would appeal to you because you're working on this project over here in your job, you know, or you live in this area, or we knew something about each other personally, so we could relate what they were thinking about to who they were as individuals. And so right away, you're starting to make all these connections and weaving everything together. And I think that brings everybody into a place where they feel very safe because they're starting to feel known. I was really struck. I did that conversation with Kara and Lauren earlier, and I think it published yesterday. And both of them said, I've never been in a place where I have felt so seen.
Yes, I saw that. Yes.
And I thought, wow, that, I mean, that just captured in a one sentence what was really going on there. Because you didn't feel like a face on a screen. You didn't feel like some unknown entity who's just attending a conference and hoping to sit in the back or whatever. You were seen as a person, as a human being, as someone. You know how Jordan Peterson always says, you should take care of yourself as though you're someone who's worth taking care of. Just the way you would take care of a family member or even take care of your dog, you know, you should take care of yourself that same way. Because what that means is you're seeing yourself as somebody valuable. They were saying in this environment, other people were seeing me as somebody valuable enough to pay attention to and to want to come in contact with, maybe even come in contact with the messy parts of me. And recognize that that's still valuable, right?
Yes. And then as just like a next step from that stream, sort of, then I started to see myself. I thought I heard one of those people say, as somebody who could be seen. I thought, wow, that's the transformation right there. That was just so such a powerful stream from what you're getting out there.
So, how does that sound to you from a sociologist perspective?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I was listening to this, I was thinking of this book by Michelle Lamont, and all of this fits in so well with the literature, because her book is called Seeing Others. That's why I sort of thought of her, but it fits. I'm pretty sure that's what her book is. It just came out this past year, but there's so much right now that's showing us. We're physically separated from other people. We're having these new levels of anxiety and stress and depression that are causing us to isolate ourselves from other people. And we both choose to not be seen, to stay in our own bubble and have our predictable routines. And then when we do that and we have these patterns of isolation, whether for the big political reasons or for the tiny reasons just having to do with us, we don't see other people. And other people don't see us, and it's in the it causes it sort of it's a self-reinforcing cycle. There's all these emotions of shame, and but I think that's the bottom line. And I think it, wow, is estuary the solution to that? Is just this having these meetings? Is that gonna be the thing where we start to see even just one other person, right, or five other people, or seven other people, however many people are in our group. And then we feel like I'm a person who can be seen. I don't know. I don't know. That's at least that's got to be a piece of the puzzle, right? So yeah,
So
I'm thinking.
if I'm a person who can be seen, then now when I go back into my environment away from the estuary group, all the people that I come in contact with, I'm going to recognize that they are also people that need to feel seen. And it's going to change my interactions with them, you know. So I remember one of Jordan Peterson's early lectures where he talked about he wasn't using this illustration, but you know, you've heard the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. Everyone is 6 degrees from Kevin Bacon. You've
Yes.
heard that, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what that really means is that each of us has a sphere of influence that's much larger than we think. So maybe my life, I might impact 1,000 people. What, you know, even if I don't have a YouTube channel, I just go through my life, I might impact 1,000 people based on my family and then the reach that my family has and, you know, my few friends and the reach that they have. You go out these 6 degrees, I might impact 1,000 people. Well, so if 1,000 people end up in estuary groups around the United States, and each of them is impacting 1,000 people, and then you've got 1 million people. And then if each of them is impacting 1,000 people, then you've got 1 billion people. I mean, it goes pretty fast, right? Once you see that you can be the change, once you see that you are a person, maybe that's what it is. To be seen is to see that you are a person and that you are a person who has value. And then you can be the change to help others see that they also are persons who have value. And that can happen with as little as just eye contact, I think. If you're in the store and you're checking out, if you give really authentic, caring eye contact to the guy at the cash register, that might just make his day. He felt seen, right?
And then that gives you, I mean, that interaction at the cash register, like with a human being, not the machine, that gives you such a boost too that you might not realize in the moment, but by doing that, you also, I mean, it's good for everybody.
Yeah. So tell me more about this book, Michelle Lamont.
Yes, she is a sociologist. She sort of has this whole body of work, but this new book that she's written, it's really great. It's specifically targeting this question of, looking at polarization, looking at, there are specific ways that probably the men in our estuary groups, feel like society doesn't see them. They might have particular problems, and our institutions might not seem like they're catering to those or listening to those in the same way that, maybe the women in our estuary groups, or people on the left or people on the right, all might have these particular ways in which institutions aren't serving them, or people aren't acknowledging, how much it takes them to get through the day. This is a big gloss on Michelle Lamont, but I'm trying to draw some connections. But just like what you're saying, once we start to see and recognize the other, we can diffuse a lot of that tension that's developed in our politics. And then, maybe we could extend that to say, well, what if we could diffuse some of this tension that's happening in our church communities, or in our homes, and in our local school boards and things like that? What if we just saw other people in some of the ways that I think you're talking about, Karen, making eye contact with them, and so one of the things, right? I don't know if we know all the things, but really listening to them. And there's got to be more, and I'm sure that Michelle Lamont has a lot more to say about that, but it does kind of sort of tie this together in a way, I think.
Well, so in the sociology world, are you running into a lot of this? We've started using a shorthand that I think is not helpful, but the shorthand is to talk about woke,
Woke and anti-woke kind of.
woke and anti-woke. Could you describe what's meant by woke and anti-woke, and then talk about whether or not you run into that in academia?
Okay, I've been doing some listening on this because it has kind of been new to hear people talk about this in this way. So I think when people are saying woke, they're referring to maybe this sort of whole lineage of ideas, like sort of the language that we use. And then I think when they say woke in this kind of pejorative way, I think they mean, well, I feel attacked when I'm asked to use a particular kind of language or think in a particular way, because maybe that's you saying that I'm wrong for thinking what I think or something like that. And so I think that's kind of the woke, and then maybe the anti-woke is kind of a pushback to this need to use particular language, need to, especially I think it comes to race as well. I think when people are, when white people are talking about Black people, I think they feel, some of the folks in the corner maybe I've heard use, you know, feel a little demoralized about Black Lives Matter, not because, you know, they did of their racial politics or attitudes, but because they feel like it's this sort of pushback to them, this sort of something's being taken from them because they're being maybe asked by sort of woke people. I don't, is this what you're getting at at all, Karen? But they're sort of being asked to maybe perform a particular way. And then the classic example I think of is Jordan Peterson and the trans sort of, you know, the question of the language that he uses to address trans people. And so there's maybe a sense of injustice that folks are being asked maybe or being maybe condemned for not having the exact same position as people on the left. Is that fair? Is that maybe a fair gloss of the woke, anti-woke? Is that how you see it?
I just want to know how you saw it, because I've heard this word tossed around for years now, long before the BLM or long before Jordan Peterson's issue with Bill C-16. The idea of woke, as I understood it, I guess, was a certain group of people started using woke about themselves to imply that they were kind of the enlightened ones.
Yeah.
They were the ones who now understood that all of history was wrong and that only today is right. And so sort of a bias against, I think it was C.S. Lewis used to talk the bias against chronology, a bias against the past, to say that the past, everybody in the past was bad, and we now have it figured out, and we are the ones who are woke. We are the ones that are correct. We're politically correct. We're linguistically correct. We know how to speak in a way that is going to be kind and compassionate towards everybody, and love humanity. Now, the downside of loving humanity is that it's way easier to love humanity than it is to love your husband. It's way easier to love humanity than it is to love your neighbor whose dog is running through your garden. You know, so I mean, there are realities that we all have to face, and that this this narrative of being correct in everything,
yes, it's being right,
isn't helpful in living your everyday life when you have to navigate difficulties. And so for me, it's kind of a difference between a utopian vision and a vision of reality, because a person who holds a utopian vision, the only way that they can ever realize that utopian vision is to somehow use force or coercion, whether it's their own force or whether they surrender their force to the government, or they surrender their force to an institution and then say to the institution, you have to enforce this thing to make it happen. So when the government or institutions begin enforcing political correctness, then you've taken agency away from everyone else who might not, everyone else who actually can see reality and the challenges of living in reality, rather than adhering to this utopian vision that is unrealizable because it doesn't align with reality. So I guess that's the way I would describe the two visions.
Sure.
And Thomas Sowell was one of the guys who wrote about this many years ago in his book, The Two Visions, where he talks about the constrained and the unconstrained vision.
Okay, that's gonna be big for me. I need to read that right away.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. It's an amazing book.
I'm just looking at the stack of books over here, thinking about there's a lot that apply to this question as well. But I want to hear what you were saying about Thomas Sowell.
Oh, well, I'm just going to leave that out there. Anybody who wants to read about the two visions, he writes about it much more eloquently than I described it, but that's the basic idea. And so for me, with Jordan Peterson, when he talked about Bill C-16 and I saw that video, I was just riveted because I understood, because I had been watching him already for quite some time, watching some of his university lectures. And I understood that what was behind what he was talking about was this larger question that had gripped his whole academic career. And that question was, how do you prevent the same kind of catastrophe happening today as the one that happened in the 20th century with Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia? And he felt that those two catastrophes happened because people gave up their individual agency and were willing to abide by the lie that the government was telling them that they had to abide by. Whether that meant ratting out their family members for saying something against the government, or whether that meant just keeping their mouths shut when their neighbor was hauled off for being disobedient to some government restriction or something. And so Jordan Peterson had been teaching for a long time that we must at all costs speak the truth, and that speaking the truth ultimately will bear good fruit, even if it means in the meantime you have to pay a horrendous price for it. So when he was talking about Bill C-16, he said, for a long time we've been asked not to say things that we would like to say, not to express opinions that we want to express, because maybe those opinions aren't politically correct. So we kept our mouths shut. But now they're telling us we must express what they tell us to express. We must say the words that they put in our mouths. And he said, I will not do that. And it's not that it's this issue in particular. It's just this is the issue that the government decided to have the hill that they were going to die on. Government of Canada said, this is the issue where you will say what we tell you to say. And Jordan Peterson said, no, I won't do that. Because truth is more important than any sort of a government diktat. And I will only speak the truth. I will not have the government put words in my mouth. And if that means that I'm breaking the law and then they ask me for $1,000 fine, I will not pay the fine because I don't believe that the law is correct. And if not paying the fine means I go to prison, I will go to prison. And when I go to prison, I will go on a fast and I will not eat. And then they'll have to deal with it. You know, if I die in prison, so be it. I will not say those words. And to me, that was the spark that lit the fire that got this whole thing started, because none of us would be here in this corner talking about these things if Jordan Peterson had not become visible to the public eye through that event. Because before that, he was just a professor out of many professors, posting his lectures online, but beyond that, nothing, right? So at that point, it lit a little spark and people said, oh, the truth is so important. We should be willing to die for the truth. Well, that's a big ask, right? That's a big ask. But what that does, I think, it puts a little steel in our spines and it says, okay, if the truth is that important, then we better darn well figure out what the truth is. Right? And I think that's part of what this little corner is about, is trying to figure out what the truth is and then try to live by it.
Yeah, that's amazing to sort of hear you kind of put it in those really clear terms. Something else that I think about when I hear that, yes, this need to live by the truth. And now I really see that motivating factor going through, and it still does. So I think that's very motivating. And then I'm also thinking about the emotions of that, this emotion of this sort of feeling, maybe, is that a betrayal by the government? This sense of betrayal, perhaps, this anger that kind of emerges. And I don't know if that's, do you see that too? Do you see, is there anger there? Are TLC people angry? Peterson Fury.
I mean, I don't see that personally in myself, at least, because we've lived with this ever encroaching government now for many, many decades. It just steals a little bit more ground every year and a little bit more ground. And then there are just a few more regulations. And we're like frogs in the pot, just waiting to boil. But little by little encroaching, little by little. And we kind of shrug our shoulders and we just go on with life and try to do our life. And then the burden gets a little heavier and a little heavier and a little heavier. And I think there might come a day when people just say, you know, that's enough. I'm not going to put up with this anymore. But I think Americans are by and large pretty flexible and are so dedicated to trying to get on with things and not let small things bug them too much. They're just going to get on with things. So, I mean, I don't see a lot of anger over that. What I see is a growing understanding of how dangerous that is and how damaging it can be. Because if everything becomes a regulation, then pretty soon nothing is a regulation. If there's a law about everything, then pretty soon people are just blasé about law. You know, I mean, if every single thing that I do is illegal, okay, whatever. You can have your laws, but I just have to get on with my life. I've got to take care of my family. I've got to earn a living. I've got to get the toilets clean, and I've got to walk the dog.
Toilets.
Yeah. And so, but what the government starts to do then is sort of shoot itself in the foot because now people aren't taking it seriously. And to me, that's the bigger danger. So, and then they do foolish things like pass laws. We have a law in this area where if shoplifting is less than $1,000, they're not going to press charges against the shoplifter. Well, you can bet that a lot of people are just walking into the store and picking up $950 worth of stuff and walking out. And all the other people who end up footing the bill for that, I mean, people will say, oh, well, you know, they have insurance, so it doesn't hurt the store. Well, it does hurt the store. I mean, it hurts us because then the store has to pay a higher insurance rate. And then they have to raise the prices on everything. And then the stores say, you know, we're not going to stock so much stuff anymore on the shelves because it's going to get stolen. So they just put a little bit of stuff on the shelves and you walk into these stores that are almost empty and you can't really shop. You have to know exactly what you want. You have to go to the store clerk and say, I need this. And they go in the back room and they bring it out. Well, pretty soon everybody's lives are diminished because of some law that got passed. That's supposed to make nice for everybody, but what it really does is it damages everybody else. And then people take government choices even less seriously. So we can't, you know, we feel like we're following a bunch of fools off a cliff. And I mean, I don't think it's anger. Maybe some people are angry. I think a lot of people are getting a sense of humor about it. But that sense of humor is sort of like shrug the shoulders and, oh, well, you know, get on with life and let these fools do what they're going to do.
The fools in the government.
Yeah. I mean, the fools that are passing these laws that are making life difficult for everybody. Mean, I live in a pretty nice neighborhood, but. Almost every week, there's several people who get their catalytic converter stolen, but the police don't do anything about it because it's so common that they don't have the resources to go after all the people doing the theft. So if you get your catalytic converter stolen, it's up to you, you know, $1,500 deductible on your car and
It's really no fun to get your catalytic converter stolen.
yeah. Has that happened to you?
My brother and other people in my family, we've lost a lot of catalytic converters.
Yeah.
Enough that I know what a catalytic converter is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Even
And so
influenza
you
came
have to
out.
kind of begin to wonder what has happened. I mean, the world wasn't like this when I was growing up, obviously. and certain things have changed. But what are, which of those things have changed in a way that has caused this to come about? That's, I think, the main question, right?
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear that sort of as you're formulating an answer to that. Like, so is it the wokeness itself that's caused this change?
Oh, no. I mean, I think the wokeness is a symptom,
Oh, but symptom.
coming out of, all of that kind of thing. I could catalog a lot of things that have changed, and I'm not saying that any of these are instrumental, but these are just things that have changed. So when I was growing up, we didn't have plastic, meaning we didn't have credit cards. Right? So you had to pay for what you wanted. The most that you could do would be something that called layaway. So if you didn't have the money right now, you could say to the store, "I want to buy this thing, but I don't have the money. So you keep it for me and I will come in every week and I will pay you. Maybe it costs $10. I'll come in every week and I'll pay you a dollar. And then at the end of 10 weeks, I can take it home with me." Okay. You still had to have the money, but you could pay it out over time and then bring, you couldn't bring it home and then pay them. You had to pay them and then bring it home. So people didn't have all that much stuff, but they also didn't have any debt. And
Absolutely,
I
no.
think that makes a big difference. There's something about the accumulation of debt that creates fear. And especially accumulating debt on credit cards where the interest rate is 20%. And then if you can't pay your card off every month, then you just have to start paying a monthly payment. And over time, the interest rate is so high that your monthly payment is only covering the interest. And so you never pay off your debt. And in the old days, they used to call that, well, before my era, there was the what they called the company store. I don't know if you ever heard about the company store. So some guy would say work for the coal mine, and he got paid so little that he never had enough money to actually buy the food he needed for the family. So he'd go to the company store, he'd put it on a chit. They would allow him, they kind of carry him on credit, but then he was always beholden to the company. So he couldn't quit and go get a job someplace else because he owed the company at the company store, which was immortalized in Tennessee Ernie Ford's song, 16 Tons, What Do You Get? Another Day Older and Deeper in Debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, because I can't come. I owe my soul to the company store. Yeah. So now the company store is the credit card companies, right? Because we put ourselves in slavery to the credit card companies. And I think that's part of what brings about the dissolution of society. So that's one thing. What is another thing that has changed? I had something top of mind when I started talking, and then I lost it kind of. Oh, 1964, Supreme Court said that prayer was no longer allowed in schools. Well, I mean, I have mixed opinions about prayer in schools. Obviously, there's people of a lot of different religions. And so, what kind of meaningful prayer could you actually have? People of all these different religions. But they did have just sort of a basic prayer when I was in school that they would say from the loudspeaker at the start of every day. And we had the Ten Commandments on the wall. So, everybody kind of knew. This is the framework that we're gathered around. There are certain things that you don't do. And then they had this prayer. Well, then the Supreme Court comes along and says, well, because there's some atheist that feels hurt by having to listen to that prayer, prayer is no longer allowed in any school anywhere. Okay, well, I mean, maybe there's something reasonable about that. But what I immediately noticed happen was that we went from having a dressing standard about how you dressed at school, what was appropriate, to immediately that standard was gone. So I graduated high school in 65. By the time 1967, when I was halfway through my college years, I was taking some education classes, and these kids were coming back from student teaching in the high schools. So we're only 3, 4 years down the road from this Supreme Court ruling. And they were saying it is so hard to teach in these classrooms, especially for the young men who were trying to teach, because the girls were wearing mini skirts that were so short you could see everything. And then the girls were so brazen that they would sit right in the front row and put their feet up on their desk so that you could look right down these mini skirts in the face of the teacher. That's how much changed in 4 years. Now, some people could say, oh, I can't, that's just coincidence. It can't have anything to do with it. But I mean, I lived through that, and I felt, and I wasn't even concerned about those things because I did not grow up in a home of faith. We never went to church. I never was introduced to anything about faith. So it wasn't like I was, oh, these people just aren't behaving like Christians. I didn't know anything about that. I could just see something has really changed here. And I could reflect back because it had happened so recently in my mind. So 63, Kennedy was assassinated. 64 was the Supreme Court ruling. 68, Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. were assassinated. So a lot of things are happening right in that time frame. So what brought that about? Was it the Supreme Court ruling, or the Supreme Court ruling arose out of something else that was already engaged and that was happening there? Those things are kind of hard to unwind, right?
I mean, I see a threat of stand like standards of decorum, standards of order that were collectively held, kind of being released, and a movement of chaos. Is
Yeah,
that the
I mean,
narrative?
it does look like that, and it probably had something to do with some sort of a move away from church attendance that was probably starting to happen about that time, which may have been connected to the rise of television. That's also hard to know, but I don't think that we didn't have a television in our home until at least the late 50s, but that may have been because we were pretty poor. So we didn't really have the funds to buy a television. But and in the early days, television was pretty banal. But as time went on, it became more and more. Some of that stuff in the 60s was pretty flagrant. It's hard to think about that now as being flagrant, but for the times, it definitely was. So there were a lot of lines being stepped over, and people feeling like you don't need to abide by these rules anymore, you know. And of course, that all culminated in the late 60s with the hippie movement, so yeah, I don't know. There were a lot of changes that happened. And a lot of riots. And then we went into the 70s, and there was this huge economic disruption that had to do with the oil shortage. And then that, excuse me, that followed on with the Jimmy Carter years, which were just horrendous and just about broke our country.
His birthday
That
today.
is,
It's his 100th birthday today, I think, isn't it?
Well, that was about the time that I started thinking, you know, I should maybe get involved. And there was something in the back of my mind, like I could have some sort of influence, which is completely ridiculous because it's a very big problem. But I got involved politically, and I started writing letters to the editor and trying to make a difference in any way that I could. I started reading history and economics and trying to understand why the economy was falling apart. And I got married, and my husband and I bought a little farmette, a little 50 acres. We had cows and chickens and ducks and geese and pigs, and we were trying to get ready for if a crash did come along, that we would be able to take care of ourselves.
I know a lot of folks feel like that today.
Well, I see some similarities to be what's happening today and what was happening in the 70s. Actually, I see similarities even in the climate. It's a little flipped because back then they said, excuse me, back then they said that we were heading into a new ice age, and the ice age was going to destroy the world, and so we had to make all these changes because of the ice age. And they were also telling us when we were young people, there's going to be so much overpopulation, but that by the year 2000, there's going to be mass starvation everywhere on the planet. And so you shouldn't have children. So we only had one child, and then after that, we stopped. If we hadn't drunk that Kool-Aid, we probably would have had more children. And there probably were other people that would have had more children. And, if that were true, we probably wouldn't be facing the population decline that we're facing today. So, I mean, all these things work together. Some little seed gets planted that creates fear in some arena, and then that changes the entire cultural move. And over my lifetime, I've seen the news media plant fear in many different areas, and all those little fears that are planted are creating these disruptions everywhere. So it's very difficult to unwind the whole thing and go back and say, what caused this? Well, there's many, as Jordan Peterson will always say, it's multivariable. You can't look at a single variable. You have to look at all of them. And so it's like a painting, lots of
Same.
different strokes.
Karen, I want to ask you a question. If I can sort of dig a little bit into something you were saying. I don't want to cut you off though, if you had a big thought. I want to ask you a question because all the way back in high school, you had listened to the was it the Lord's Prayer or something read over the loudspeakers, but you didn't come from a religious family. And some atheists had said something about that was the reason why the Supreme Court ruling had to happen. And this is a person, this isn't even a sociological question. This is an estuarial question, maybe. I was that atheist in my high school. I contacted an organization called the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and I don't even remember that. We don't need to get to the logistics, but there was something religious happening in my high school, and I felt that it was, a high schooler, right? Way back when. I go to Notre Dame now, so I'm not anti-religious. I don't want to give that idea. But I contacted the organization and I said, well, maybe this doesn't belong in our school. We have this constitutional right because of that Supreme Court ruling. And so I wanted to know, like, kind of what you were thinking at that time as somebody who was, in high school listening to the Lord's Prayer. It was part of an order that sort of sustained, less chaos for you is kind of what I'm hearing. I don't know. I wanted you to hear you sort of reflect more on as you didn't come up with.
Well, I'll answer that question if you'll answer one for me. Okay, so when you were this atheist in high school, what was it that was offensive to you, and how did you understand your constitutional right in that situation?
Oh, that's a good question. Okay, what was offensive to me, and how did I understand my right? The thing that what bothered me was that it was a play. I was being asked to participate in a religious service, to sing in a religious service for a grade, with this class, and
Oh,
so
now, so that's interesting. I have never heard of anything like that. So what were
what
they
was
asking you to do?
so it was like a baccalaureate service, so like a Like before graduation or during sort of that graduation season, the choir goes and they perform, at this Christian, very Christian, religious service to honor, the graduating students that year.
This is before the graduation service. This is a separate thing.
This is separate. It's a
Okay.
separate thing, but the choir members. One of the grades was that you had to participate, and I went through all the, I went through all the sort of the non-confrontational sort of things, like talking to the teacher and talking to eventually the principal. And I was just kind of belittled and, I would say mistreated, looking back. But we all think we're mistreated, right? And so I contacted this organization because I thought my right to get back to your question there was that I wouldn't have to do religion for a grade, that you didn't have to have any particular willingness to perform a religious ritual as part of your education and your schooling. Just to summarize that, and that's even first, just like the First Amendment that if you're in a public school, what does the First Amendment even say now? I got to think. It just protects your right to the freedom of religion and press and so forth. So, we'd really have to dig into that to find the legal
Well,
reasoning.
the way you're explaining, I can understand why it felt unfair to you. And especially if you're being asked to participate, if your participation in the choir required you to participate in a religious service. Okay. Now, I am going to answer your question and then I'm going to pose an alternative view to that experience. Okay. So for me, when I was going through that in my high school, it didn't matter to me one single bit. Okay, the Supreme Court passed a ruling. What does this even mean? I was in a fog most of my life anyway. I became a Christian when I was 30, and up until that point, I don't think I had an original thought. So I was in a fog up until I was 30 years old, and then my brain turned on. And maybe that's not other people's experience, but that was my experience. So I'm in this fog. I'm going through high school. The main thing that I noticed was I didn't have to abide by the dress code anymore. I could wear whatever I wanted to wear. So that was the only change that happened for me. It wasn't until I got into college, and maybe I did start growing up a little bit, and I started becoming more observant about things. And I noticed this change that was happening in the way people were dressing and in the way people were approaching school. And they were becoming more belligerent about their rights and more belligerent about being able to express themselves in their own way and all of that kind of thing. And I started noticing that. I noticed it more in hindsight than I did when I was experiencing it at the moment. Okay. But then as time went on and I started kind of exploring these ideas more in depth. Like when I was 30 and I became a Christian, I started reading Thomas Sowell and Walter Williams and all these great thinkers who are not religious thinkers, but economic thinkers talking about economic realities and all that kind of thing. And I started thinking about things like your situation, being put in that situation where you had to participate in a religious service. But if you can look at it from the other side of people who are people of deep faith, and they're all the time being asked to participate in things that are faithless and that are against their faith, and they have no way to opt out of that because that's how the world sees that as, oh, well, that's just secular. So you're not being asked to do anything against your faith. That's just secular. But in reality, the secular thing is actually its own kind of a religion. It's saying, this is what's true. So you're going to participate in this because this is what's true. Let's say it's a, some class where you have to memorize a lot of things that you think are not true, but you have to say that they're true in order to pass the test. And that we just expect that all the time of people of faith. Regardless of what their faith is, whether they're Mormon or Sikh or Jewish or Christian or whatever, they're continually confronted by the secular world saying, you've got to get in line and abide by what we say. And there's no out for you because you have freedom of religion. You can go practice your religion on Sunday, and then the rest of the week, you're just going to get in line. So yes, I can understand why an atheist might feel offended by having to participate in a religious service, but Christians and people of other faiths have to do that 95% of their time. So that was something I didn't understand until after I got on the other side of the divide And then I could kind of see, oh, this is why it's painful for people, right?
Sure.
Yeah. So, and if I didn't have that understanding on from the other side, I wouldn't even be able to understand the pain that you experienced when you were put in that situation in high school. Now, my high school choir did a lot of religious music because
Sure.
back then that was very common. But then in later years, both of my daughters going through school, well, my older daughter, when she went through school, the choir and band couldn't do religious music because now it's constitutionally forbidden. So what we're doing is we either go way over on one side of the spectrum or way over on the other, instead of saying, let's, harmonize and bring all of these. I apologize. I'm getting over some sort of a bronchial something or other that I picked up
Oh no.
traveling back from the conference, and it's hard to get my breath sometimes, but.
Oh, that's terrible. That's terrible. I got so sick before the conference, and then I was sick for like a month, like the whole month before the conference. I was getting over it, and I thought I'm not going to be able to go. But I feel terrible that you're sick now.
Well, I'm not sick.
Not
I
sick, not
feel
sick.
fine. It's just that I'm coughing. I'm still coughing a lot, but last week was a lot worse, so I'm definitely on the upswing.
Yeah,
It's
yeah.
the upward trajectory. It's not where you are right now, but are you on an upward trajectory? That's what counts, right?
Yes. Are you
So
seeing any?
anyway, I mean, that's my perspective on how complicated it is to look at the changes that have taken place. And I think one of the reasons that we don't make progress is that we don't actually look back in time and try to understand how we got where we are. But one of the things I really appreciate about this little corner is trying to understand where the meaning crisis arose from. So the people who are thinking about it are willing to go all the way back to 1300 and look at Occam, or to go, go back into the 1500s and look at, some of the things that came up in the Renaissance or whatever. Let's look back in history and try to figure out how we got where we are. But typically, the way that the legal system or the government works is to say, oh, we have this problem. Let's tackle this problem. Let's put a Band-Aid on it, or let's give it some medicine and we'll fix the problem. But what we're doing is just fixing the tentacles of the problem. The problem itself is still sitting back there in 1960 or 1968 or whatever. And one of those is like the healthcare system. That problem goes all the way back to post-war, when the government decided that they were going to give companies the opportunity to provide health insurance to their employees as a perk that would not be taxed to the employee. So companies could say, oh, come work for us, we'll give you this health insurance. Well, the minute that they did that, that opens up a pool of money that's flowing into the healthcare system. And not very long after that, they came in with Medicare and HMOs and all these things, which increases the pool of money. The more money that's flowing in, you're going to increase the cost of everything. That's just the way economics works. And so our healthcare system has been ratcheting up ever since then. And now I don't know what it's like where you live, but where I live, there are palaces popping up everywhere that are these healthcare centers. That are really, they're like palaces. In one of our healthcare centers here, there's a Dale Chihuly sculpture in the front lobby that was well over $1 million. Of course, given by a donor to make the facility beautiful, but that donor's $1 million could have gone to healthcare and not into the,
Yeah.
but more and more ground, more and more real estate is being taken up in healthcare facilities. Because the money has flowed in. The same thing happened in the colleges with the student loans. The student loans were just coming in when I was graduating from college. So we had just begun student loans when I was in college, and I took out a little bit. But after that, the student loans got more and more and more and more. That's throwing all this money into the colleges, and then the colleges begin building. We've got all this money, we got to prepare for the students coming in. Building, 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 building. Now there's universities with these palaces everywhere. And that has increased the cost of education for everybody, which increases the need for student loans, which increases the need for debt. I mean,
What if we just provided people with health care? What if we just provided people with education?
well, when I was in the state legislature, I ran the numbers on that because at that point, the state was subsidizing student loans because we were in a time, believe it or not, where the mortgage interest was 18% to buy a house.
That's high.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. That is high. It went from 8 to 13 to 18 within just a few years because once inflation gets going, that's what happens.
That's
So
unthinkable.
the state was subsidizing interest and saying, we'll give you a student loan at only 8%, only
For a student
8%.
loan, that's much higher than
8%
it.
is high, right?
Yeah.
But it's not 18%. So the state was subsidizing that. Well, I ran the numbers and I figured that the subsidy on the loan over the course of the loan was more money than if we just gave the students the money to start with to get their tuition.
Like a Pell Grant situation, but at the state level.
Yeah, I mean, it's absurd once you start in with these subsidies on the student loans. But if today we just say we're going to give everybody an education, we've created a situation where now education is so expensive that if we were going to give everybody an education, it would bankrupt the entire system.
Yeah, well, and the truth is that not everybody needs the same type of education.
Yes.
Or wants it.
Yeah. But of course, if you make it free, everybody's going to get it whether they need it or want it because it's free. You know how people are when something is free. I'm going to take it whether I need it or not. This is why when you have a buffet and you see all you can eat for $8.99, people pile up their plates and throw away 90% of it because that's the way we are.
Sure.
It's built into us. Oh, I've got it coming to me, so I'm going to get it.
You know, that reminds me of this funny anecdote about Red Lobster and the shrimp, that people made fun of Red Lobster, who went out of business recently because of the all-you-can-eat shrimp. That's the picture that comes to my mind when you talk about this.
Didn't know that they had all you can eat shrimp. The thing I remember about Red Lobster are those beautiful cheese biscuits. Oh my gosh, they're so good.
Okay, that's yeah. Cheese in any form.
Yeah, but their cheese biscuits were amazing. But fortunately, maybe still you can still buy their boxed biscuit mix at the supermarket. So,
Yes. That's amazing. I like to ask people what their favorite flavor of ice cream is, but I feel like just your cheese biscuit analogy is.
what is your favorite flavor of ice cream?
My favorite flavor of ice cream?
Uh-huh.
I should come in with an answer because I ask everybody this question, but this week only, my favorite flavor is pumpkin pie with like the actual pie shells mixed into the ice cream, frozen custard.
Oh, wow. Where do you get that?
There's this beautiful little creamery right by my house, and it's this cute little place. They recently closed for the winter, but I might be able to go back, and sneak in and get a quart or something.
Uh-huh.
What about you, Karen? What's your favorite flavor?
Well, I particularly stay away from Baskin Robbins in the spring because they have a flavor called Tax Crunch, which only comes out during tax season. And it is so good that I wouldn't be able to resist. So I just can't go near them at all anymore. But it's such an amazing ice cream. I think the base might be a coffee ice cream. But then it's mixed into it are flakes of dark chocolate.
Yes.
Really thin flakes of dark chocolate mixed in, like a stracciatella. And really thin flakes of some kind of toffee, crispy toffee, and then some kind of toasted nut. And all those things are mixed into this coffee base. And so when you bite into it, there's this crunch. It's amazing.
Okay, that sounds real. I'm gonna have to go in tax season and get I'm gonna look forward to tax season now.
Know, right?
I can get my ice cream.
I haven't had it in like 10 years because once I get started, I can't stop. So
Well.
there you go. And if I did that, then I would need those young men to hoist me up the stairs.
It would be worth it. It would be worth it.
So, yeah, we have a lot of problems in this country. We have a lot of problems in the world. And I think the only way we can solve them is if we're willing to start talking to each other and finding out how they started and really tackling the problem itself instead of tackling the symptoms of the problem.
Yes, and we can do that if we are willing to look at each other and maybe garner a sense of belonging that doesn't necessarily specifically relate to our particular political litmus tests that we sometimes have for each other.
Absolutely. And maybe even if we could see our government leaders and see our politicians as human beings and let them know that they're seen and that might change them. Who knows?
I like it. Yes. On every side.
And you can be the change in your sociology department.
I hope so. I
That
do go
all
to Notre Dame, so it's kind of it's a little more balanced than some people think.
Well, so we have like 3 minutes left. Tell me about that.
Okay. It's balanced in that we had Bushell Lamont speak about her book, Seeing Others, recently. I didn't get to hear the whole talk, but really the spirit of looking at people on every side of the aisle and saying, actually, it's a great book. There's a book that someone on my committee wrote, Politics of Losing. This is Rory McVeigh, his book with Aesop, Ryan, I think, Aesop. Looking at some of the problems that have circulated for a long time for folks on the right, and this particular work addresses the what happens when someone like Trump loses, but also what happens when folks are made to feel like they're less than, and losing. So I'm going on a rant now, thinking about this book argument. But it's really about seeing everybody. It ties in, I promise. Seeing the other as real, credible, and not dismissing someone just because, well, they might vote a different way than me. They might think differently than me. They might be in flyover country. Another work I'd mention would be Arlie Hochschild's Strangers in Our Own Land, just how we don't see each other, also addressing that. So these are ideas that are being talked about in my sociology department, but it's not just the sort of woke, liberal, left type of, sociology I think some people have in their mind. But it really is a lot more about we don't just dismiss someone because they vote differently than us. I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, well, I mean, it has to be that way. We'll never get anywhere if we can't get back to the space of recognizing. And I think what a lot of people don't understand is this whole idea of how they're impacted by their worldview. And part of what happens in estuary, I think, is that people can start to understand that they do have a worldview and see that other people have a different worldview. So if you have this like completely different way of seeing an event, I think Scott Adams used to call it two different movies on the same screen. We're both looking at the same screen, but we're seeing two different movies. So if you don't have an understanding that that's what's happening, it makes communication impossible. But once you understand that that's what's happening, then you can start to unwind these two movies and kind of understand what the other person is seeing. And then hopefully they can understand what you're seeing. And then maybe you can recognize, well, we're both kind of seeing the same thing, but we're seeing it from these two different windows. So maybe we could get together and see what it is that we're actually seeing, not just our own perspectives on it, but what's actually there. And I think that's the hope of estuary, because there is a there.
Yes.
Reality is a thing. Reality actually does exist. And
Absolutely.
And I think reality and truth are the same thing. And Jordan Peterson is telling us that we have to find the truth and speak the truth in order to survive. So that's the goal. Well, it's really good, Clara. Thank you so much. You ask really good questions.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate, getting to know you a little better. So it's been really nice to hear from you as well.
And you managed to avoid getting too personal the whole time. So.
Did I gave you a big anecdote, huge personal anecdote. But thank you.
Oh, I thought you just said, I can give you a big personal anecdote.
Oh.
That's not what you said?
No, I already did give you a big personal anecdote.
Oh, okay.
It's been done.
Okay. I won't egg you too hard then. Have a great day, Clara.
You too. Thank you.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Bye.